Let's begin this morning with a conversation about corporate favoritism. We've all seen it firsthand in competitions to land Foxconn and Amazon's new headquarters. Corporations focused more on gaining government privilege and access than to do it the old-fashioned way. Joining us this morning here on the program is Dr. Matthew Mitchell, who's a senior research fellow and director of equity initiative at the Mercatus Center. Dr. Mitchell, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you here with us because of the research that you've done, kind of timely with us here in the Chicago area on a couple of different fronts. We were a finalist for the Amazon headquarters in Chicago, and then we have Foxconn to the north, and some of what you've done research on deals with those two companies. I want to start first by giving our listeners a little background into government favoritism and some of the things that you've questioned corporate leaders about. Give our listeners a sense of what we'll be talking about here.
Sure. So, you know, for years, economists have been looking at the economic effects of favoritism. Do corporate subsidies benefit the communities that offer them? You know, how does it affect growth? How does it affect the behavior of entrepreneurs and consumer prices and growth rates? And all of that is very important. I should add that most of the evidence there is pretty depressing. It suggests that corporate subsidies and favors do not actually benefit the communities that offer them. But in many ways, a lot of that research has been sort of materialist. What is the economic effect of this stuff? And what we wanted to set out to do was to see what is the social and cultural effect of favoritism. So we wanted to see how do business leaders who work at firms that are favored perceive, how does it correlate with certain perceptions of markets, of government, and of favoritism itself?
And so the questions were to business leaders who were favored, who thought themselves to be favored, and those who didn't. Talk to us a little bit about the questions you asked and what the findings were.
Sure. So we interviewed a population of 500 American business leaders. They needed to be people who had some degree of decision-making ability over their firms, and we had a number of ways of checking to make sure that was the case. And the first question we asked simply was, okay, what sort of types of policies does your firm benefit from? And these were questions that were aimed at identifying whether or not their firm received privileges from government. So, you know, do you recently receive or have you ever received direct loans from government or loan guarantees or subsidies or bailouts or the expectation of bailouts? So that was sort of the first baseline question. And what we found there was 61% of business leaders perceived that their firms benefit from at least one variety of favoritism. And then we dug a little deeper. Once we have the idea of, okay, whether or not the business leader believes his firm benefits from government privilege, the next questions were designed to see, okay, how does that then correlate with certain perceptions? So what do you think about a free enterprise? What do you think about competition? What do you think about government regulation and about favoritism itself? And what we found is when you believe your firm benefits from privilege, you have systematically different beliefs about these types of things. Other business leaders who do not think that their firms benefit from privilege.
And those ideas, too, about regulation and competition in the economy were kind of surprising. Talk to us a little bit specifically about those.
Yeah. So basically what we found is that those business leaders who believe that their firms are favored are more comfortable with government intervention in the economy. They're more inclined to say that regulation is a good thing. They're also more skeptical of competition. They tend to think that competition is unfair to business, or they're more likely to think that competition is unfair to business compared with other business leaders. When we ask them about free enterprise, that's interesting. It's a little bit contradictory. Those who work for favored firms are actually more inclined to say that they favor free enterprise in the abstract. But then when we get down to more nuts and bolts and we ask them, do you think that the current U.S. economy is too free, not free enough, or just about right, they're actually less inclined to say that it's they're actually more inclined to say that it's too free, and they're less inclined to say that it's not free enough. So I take that as sort of evidence that maybe they favor free enterprise in the abstract, but You know, currently in the U.S., they'd actually prefer a more significant role for government in the economy.
You know, here in the Chicago area, we've had two instances over the last years or so. One, we were a finalist for the Amazon headquarters. The other was Foxconn's new headquarters, our new plant in southeast Wisconsin, not far from here. In the context of what you've researched and the questions you've been asking, can you put those two deals sort of in a little bit of perspective for us?
Yeah, so to me, this suggests that favoritism has some sort of effect on the way business leaders think about their role in society. So it seems to not only, change business leaders' activities, and, you know, they're more likely to pursue subsidized activities or chase after subsidies, but it also seems to affect the way that they think about business. They're more inclined to be comfortable with favoritism itself. We found that business leaders who work for favorite firms are twice as likely as other business leaders to say that it's proper and appropriate for government to favor particular businesses or industries. They also seem to have more of a sort of confused view of free enterprise. So, you know, economists have basically made the case for centuries that you need to draw a distinction between being pro-business and pro-free enterprise. You know, economists since Adam Smith have said, free market should have generally low taxes and generally low regulations. And sure, that can benefit firms, but that doesn't mean that that you should favor particular firms or industries, that you should subsidize particular firms or industries. And so it's contradictory to say that on the one hand, the market should be free, but on the other hand, government should favor particular firms or industries. And what we find is that those who are believe that they work for favored firms are more than three times as likely to hold that contradictory set of beliefs.
Based on what the answers are to your research question here, based on the findings of your research, do we change the definition of success in business based on some of this?
Well, you know, I think unfortunately we're sort of witnessing that change in the definition of success. So, you know, I think in a genuinely open and free competitive economy, success is about finding new ways to please consumers, making products that are at lower cost and higher quality for them. Unfortunately, there's another way to profit, and that's by seeking special favor or privilege. And it can be financially successful, even if it is not socially beneficial.
And it can also be financially expensive to the other side of this equation, which are the taxpayers and consumers, can't it?
Yes, that's right. And so that gets to sort of the other side of the research, which is that the vast majority of economic evidence suggests that this stuff doesn't even work. You know, the idea of, Foxconn of Wisconsin subsidizing Foxconn is that, you know, we'll do this and it will benefit the community. But there's not much economic evidence that it will. And the reason is there's an opportunity cost. So, you know, with the $3.5 billion that the state of Wisconsin is giving to one and only one firm, they could have cut the corporate income tax rate, which is paid by tens of thousands of firms in the state. They could have cut it by about 20%. So, you know, with that huge opportunity cost, you can imagine how many other types of full-time employees, new investments, new ventures could have been created if they had pursued a different course.
Is all of this undermining our faith in markets and economic freedom? I think in the case of Wisconsin, people will probably tell you that, yes, it is, based on Foxconn. But what do you think the answer is to that elsewhere?
Yeah, I think there is some evidence to that. So, you know, for one thing, you find that those states that are more likely to hand out subsidies actually have lower levels of measured economic freedom. Another way to put that is if you tend to give out more subsidies, you tend to have higher regulations and higher taxes. And it's not clear which way the causation runs. It could be that they have to maybe places that have high regulations and high taxes have to give out subsidies in order to sort of make up for their otherwise poor economic environment. I hate to say it, but that may be the case with Illinois. But the causation could run in the other direction. You know, the more subsidies you hand out, you know, that's costly, and you may have to raise taxes to make up for that. And so ultimately, I agree with you. I think there's a possibility that this will undermine people's faith in both markets and governments. It essentially teaches people the lesson that, the way to get ahead is not to create a better mousetrap, come up with a new way to please customers at low cost, but to just figure out a new way to seek favor or privilege from government.
Has this given you a jumping off point for the next piece you'd like to research? What questions were left from this research that you may want to move forward on?
Well, I think one thing I'd be interested in seeing is repeating the survey in a few years. You know, we're in the midst of a lot of change right now. I think the Amazon deal actually is, and the Foxconn deal are sort of watershed in the sense that people are not as genuinely pleased about this as I think the subsidy, those who handing out the subsidies thought they would be. I think Governor Cuomo in New York is sort of discovering, much to his chagrin, that his constituents weren't all that pleased to hand out favors. So we may actually be witnessing some shifting attitudes toward the toward this type of thing. And so I'd like to repeat the survey in a few years and see what changes.
I'm fascinated, too, to know more about the Equality Initiative there at Mercatus. You're the director and senior research fellow there. This kind of falls in line with the things that you're researching and covering with the foundation, isn't it, or the initiative?
Yeah, yeah. So the idea here is actually to draw a distinction between equality and equity, and that, you know, we can disagree about whether or not people should be made equal, but really there ought not to be much disagreement about whether they should be treated equitably. Equitable treatment, the idea that people are going to be treated fairly, especially if they are the same, you know, income or the same type of business, that's pretty much a bedrock of both our democracy and also, you know, genuine free market capitalism. It requires a level playing field in order for people to compete.
Well, Dr. Mitchell, we appreciate you being with us this morning and sharing your research.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today.
Dr. Matthew Mitchell, Senior Research Fellow and Director of Equity Initiative at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University in Virginia. You can find more online at mercatus.org.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Tuesday edition of The Opening Bell. Religion in the workplace might sound controversial on first blush, but there are some CEOs and other business leaders who bring their faith with them to the office every morning. Let's bring in Dale Buss this morning, who's a contributor at the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, and Chief Executive Magazine, where his latest piece appears, Have Faith When You Bring Religious Values to Work. Dale, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. I hope you're doing well as well. This is a really cool piece, interesting piece. Because, as I mentioned in the opening, lots of business leaders do bring their faith in some capacity with them to the C-suite. Talk to us about it a little bit.
Yeah, it really is. Well, just, you know, as your slogan for the show, the life of business and the business of life is really how these CEOs look at it. And I think a lot of people are familiar with sort of high-profile Christian CEOs who have made faith, you know, they've worn it on their sleeve. They've made it part of the culture of the companies. People like Dan Cathy, whose father, Truett Cathy, founded Chick-fil-A. And, you know, famously, they are not open on Sundays. And, of course, several years ago, ran into controversy over their views about traditional family and traditional marriage. You know, and have largely stuck by those views, although kind of receded to privacy on them. And then there's Steve Green, the founder of Hobby Lobby, the big box craft and hobby stores. I mean, he's been very forward about his faith to the point of getting involved in Supreme Court cases over what he has to do and doesn't do. But my story really is about the thousands of other CEOs who bring their faith to work, who, you know, actually established their companies in large part on their faith and used their religious values as a way of leading people and relying on God for, you know, really for the fate of their companies. And it's not just Christians either. I ran across people like Shmuel Niewisch, an Orthodox Jew in Montreal, whose family company is kind of an equity firm, and he uses his his Orthodox Jewish values and how he looks at his company, how he looks at business. And I also talked to a woman named Azra Kalfan, and a Muslim who owns a plaque company in New York City. You know, wears a burqa in business, and you know, is proud about her faith and values and how they shape the way she leads her company.
And that's one of the quotes from her in your story. She talks about how she does run her company by Islamic values, doing business fairly, being honest, providing value, having good relationships. That sounds like a model for just about everybody, even if you're not religious.
Right. And I think here what comes into play is, you know, people like her, and there's a guy interviewed named Nathan Sheets, who runs Nature Nate's Honey, a company in Texas, and he exercises values that he would call Christian, you know, in a lot of ways similar to what Azra was talking about. But the whole point is, you know, to have a philosophy of management that these people see as being authentic. And in an era that's, you know, we all know, increasingly secular, this can have a lot of appeal to people because they know what they're getting into, and they know what decisions and philosophy are sort of guiding the people who are leading their company. And so it doesn't always work out, obviously. It isn't attractive to everyone, and there can be some controversy involved as well. Maybe sometimes employees think their leaders are being hypocritical because they say, oh, I'm leading by Christian values, and they make a disappointing decision or whatever. But in an era when secularism reigns, there are a lot of people who feel like, yeah, I want to work in a place where I know exactly where the leader's coming from, and I think they're coming from basically a good place.
What are the dangers here in terms of the changing demographics of the workforce? I know some of the younger folks coming up are not necessarily religious. As a matter of fact, there's some surveys that show that there is a large percentage of them that don't feel that way. Are we headed for some sort of clash, or can we keep this? Can CEOs who bring faith, their faith values to work, survive and succeed with those demographics?
Well, I think both, basically. I mean, clearly, religious values are more divisive in the sense that they're being attacked more robustly these days than probably ever would have been imagined in an earlier era. You know, we're used to the cases of, for instance, the cake baker, and I think it's Denver, who, you know, is subject of great controversy because he wouldn't make a cake for a gay wedding, that kind of thing. So, and you have religious values increasingly under attack in the public square, let's put it that way. So that can happen in the workplace as well. And you mentioned demographics. I mean, millennials are certainly the least interested generation we've had in terms of organized religion. And yet they also are the generation that most longs for a job in a workplace to give them a sense of community. And so, in that sense, leaders who take their faith seriously and the great values that religions can bring, you know, can really create a great workplace for millennials that can attract them because they're looking for something that goes beyond tradition as well in their workplace. So it can kind of cut both ways.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the story begins with a story about Joel Manby from the CEO of SeaWorld, talking about how leading with love really translates into what millennials are looking for wanting from the workplace.
Yeah, Joel's a friend of mine. He actually is an old GM guy from Detroit, and he went to a company called Hirschend Family Entertainment. They own places like Dollywood in Tennessee and in Branson, Missouri, favorite vacation land for Chicagoans. They own properties there. And he actually, along with the founders, established an idea of servant leadership where the whole focus is on, you know, how can we serve literally both our employees and our customers and make them feel, you know, the source of our service and our approach to them is our faith, and do it in a, you know, not a confrontational way, but just really in a joyous way. And, you know, he found that this can have a tremendous impact on a company and how it's perceived, not just by people who are religious necessarily, but people who may not have faith themselves, but who like to work at a company where the people do.
It's interesting, too, because if it's a publicly held company, the goal is to make money. We've all heard the term greed is good. How do those two, the value of making money, sort of contradict with the idea of charity and the other things that go along with religion?
Well, it's kind of interesting because there's a parallel in the secular sense these days in that a lot of people don't want to work for a company that only stands for making dollars and cents, right? I mean, the traditional measure is you make money for your shareholders if you're a publicly held company, and that's really all you worry about. But today, boards and CEOs increasingly say, no, our company has to stand for something more, has to stand for some kind of sublime values, whether it's environmentalism, whether it's some kind of political statement, whatever. So already CEOs and boards, even of publicly held companies, had this kind of approach and attitude saying we can't just stand for dollars and cents. And so in that sense, having a company that's built on a faith culture or a faith philosophy, you know, can fit in fairly well, even with a publicly held company, although, you know, leaders of those companies have to be a little bit more careful about expressing openly that this is a faith-based thing. It's a lot easier if you run the company, you own it, and you don't have to worry about shareholders.
Yeah, absolutely. Dale, good conversation. Thank you for sharing it with us this morning.
All right, thank you.
Dale Buss, who is a contributor this time around at Chief Executive Magazine. His latest piece, Have Feet of Faith When You Bring Religious Values to Work, is online now at chiefexecutive.net, and we will link out to it in the podcast of The Opening Bell a little bit later this morning at WGNradio.com.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are looking for some direction this morning. It looks like it might be a flat open to the day on Wall Street. Dow futures are up just 9 points this morning. S&P futures up just a fraction. And NASDAQ futures are now flat this morning. Let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. A pretty good bounce back in the grain market yesterday. Corn, soybeans, and wheat all moving higher, rebounding from that sell-off on Friday, with corn notching the biggest gain, up 1.8% yesterday. Soybean futures also getting support from optimism about a trade deal with China after USDA said private exporters reported the sale of 828,000 tons of soybeans. Cattle prices rebounded a little bit with the June cattle contract up 40 cents and the April feeder cattle contract up 32 cents, a hundredweight for the day. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. A couple of more stories here before we leave you this morning. Boeing says that it will need a little bit more time to submit the final software fix for the 737 MAX jet. Federal Aviation Administration said late yesterday that it expects the company to submit the software fix sometime in the coming weeks. Statement from the FAA said is needed for additional work by Boeing as the result of an ongoing review of the 737 MAX flight control system to ensure that Boeing has identified and appropriately addressed all pertinent issues. The agency and Boeing under fire following two fatal crashes of the popular 737 MAX jets since October. The FAA said it'll conduct a rigorous safety review, and the software that's suspected of contributing to both crashes won't be installed until it is satisfied. The FAA is satisfied that it is working. Bitcoin jumped suddenly today following months of relatively low volatility in an asset once known for its wild price swings. Price of the world's largest cryptocurrency bounced nearly 14% higher to $4,700, according to CoinDesk data. That's the highest level that Bitcoin has reached since late November. Bitcoin also briefly touched the $5,000 mark on the Luxembourg Bitstamp exchange. The digital asset has added over $14 billion to its market value in the last 24 hours, according to CoinMarketCap. Also today, the World Trade Organization has cut its forecast for trade growth this year by more than a percentage point to 2.6%. It's due to an economic slowdown and amid a trade conflict between the United States and China. The Geneva-based trade body expects an uptick in growth by volume to 3% next year. On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this Tuesday, April the 2nd, some things on the calendar today as we look to see what is happening around the world. Durable goods orders are due. We'll also get a check of the Red Book, also motor vehicle sales coming today as well. On the earnings calendar, a number of companies reporting quarterly earnings today, including Dave and Buster's, GameStop, and Walgreens earnings. We'll also see tomorrow the ISM services report, USS ISM services. Also, the Reserve Bank of India rate decision coming tomorrow. The March jobs report is on Friday. So we have plenty of things to look forward to on the calendar this week as well. But several things today could move the markets on this Tuesday, April the 2nd.